You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Martin Indyk, the Director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. And it's my honor today to introduce you to Akbar Ahmed and his wonderful new book, The Thistle and the Drone, which, of course, you can purchase outside afterwards, and I'm sure you'll all want to do that. The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War on Tribal Islam, is the third of Akbar Ahmed's books, all of them published by Brookings, I'm proud to say, in which he has examined the relationship between the United States and the Muslim world in the wake of the terrible terrorist attack of 9/11. It is, I think, the most provocative of his three books, each of them excellent in their own right, because it makes the argument that we have fundamentally misunderstood the way in which the war on terror has morphed into a war on tribal Islam. And it is the tribal dimensions of the war on terror that are the subject of this book. And what I think makes it so unique, and as I said, so provocative in its conclusions. For those of you who don't know, Akbar Ahmed is the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington. He is also a non-resident senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World here at Brookings. He is our most distinguished member of our fellows who work on in this project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world. He holds degrees from Birmingham University, Cambridge University, and SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He joined the Civil Service of Pakistan, the CSP, which is the elite cadre of Central Superior Services of Pakistan, in 1966, and held important posts in Pakistan and Bangladesh, including Commissioner of Quetta Province and political agent in the South Waziristan Agency in the 1970s. And it is the experience of his time there in South Waziristan that so informs the study that he has written about here in this book, as he will no doubt explain to you. After Professor Ahmed makes his presentation, we are going to welcome to the podium Sally Quinn and Mawahid Shah, who are going to comment on the book, and we're going to have a kind of three-way or four-way conversation with its author. Mawahid Shah is an attorney at law, author, and policy analyst, and from 2003 to 2007, he served as minister and special assistant to the Punjab Chief Minister of Pakistan. Sally Quinn is probably known to you all and surely needs no introduction, as the editor-in-chief of the Washington Post's On Faith column and the author of several best-selling books. So please join me in welcoming our very distinguished guest today, Professor Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you so much, Martin, for that very warm introduction. And I do want to welcome all of you here this afternoon, assembled to help us launch this book. As you know, the launching of a book, the creation of a book, the completion of a book takes a lot of effort, and many people are involved. particularly in a book of this nature, as Ambassador Indyk has just pointed out. I can't name everyone. Many of you are named in the book. But this afternoon, I would like to thank some people. I would like to begin with Ambassador Martin Indyk himself. He has always been a great friend, a great patron. And I think I got probably one of the greatest compliments that a Muslim can be given from South Asia, when after some performance of one of my plays on stage, on the panel, he called me the Dara Shikoh of South Asian Islam. For those of you not familiar with that name, do look it up. Unfortunately, the character ends badly because he's actually executed by his other brother. But he does fight for peace and compassion and bringing people together. That's what matters. I would like to thank Brookings, the Saban Center. Welcome Tamara Witz. She will be with us in future events together we plan to do. And I would like to thank the panel, the very distinguished panel, my friends Sally Quinn, a star here in Washington, D.C. I'm delighted she's here. My friend Mohaid, we go back many, many decades. He's one of the brightest intellectuals from South Asia and very vocal, and you'll hear that today. He's a very honest intellectual. And my friend Khalid Aziz. Martin mentioned I belong to the 66 batch. Khalid Aziz is 69 batch and becomes the political agent in North Waziristan. I was in the South. And he was also chief secretary of the frontier province in Peshawar. He'll be speaking to us via video. I'd like to thank the Brookings Press. No good book can be published without an excellent press backing it. And I don't think I could have asked for a better press. Brookings Press has been absolutely first class. And it's headed by the wise and wonderful Bob Fatty, Bob over there, I'm once again grateful to you, my friend, and your excellent team, Chris and Melissa, and I know how they have been so active in already promoting this book in the media. And, of course, the senior editor, Janet Walker. I often think to myself that had Janet Walker been a Catholic and had I been a Pope, she would have been Saint Janet Walker a long time ago. I'd like to thank my family. My wonderful wife, Zenith. She has always been available to any of my projects, whatever the circumstances, whether she's in ill health or she's got other things on her mind, she's always supported me. And very often, I wake up early in the morning and I dictate about 1,000 words even before I get to office, where Asia is, of course, waiting for me very anxiously. Babar, Omar, Nafis, and Melody, who's just joined us, and her beautiful son. The book is dedicated to my grandson, and I'm delighted he's here, so if he becomes too noisy, I'm sure his mother will slip out. And now I must thank the team. This book really is mine, but it is also theirs. They have contributed very significantly and substantially to it, but most important, they have committed emotion and passion and their ideals in this book and in this project. We often hear of the greatest generation of Americans, and we salute them. They really took on the world, in a sense, and changed the direction of history. And we often ask, certainly the senior generation, what is happening to this present generation? We have all kinds of skeptical doubts about the young generation and their capacity for pleasure and self-indulgence and so on. Well, if you ever want to know about this young generation, look at members of my team. I have been inspired, and it's not easy to inspire me, by their passion, by their commitment, by their loyalty, by their dedication, by their pursuit of knowledge. And above all, I have tested them in the field. When I went to Cambridge last term as a visiting professor, I was coming back, in a sense, home, because I had been there many years in the UK. I knew a lot of people. So there were many events. I spoke at the House of Lords, at the US Embassy. We had a big event, many lectures, talks, dinners, lunches. And Harrison decided to come from the United States and work with me there. And he really arrived like the proverbial Marines. And once he arrived there, he handled the Lords and the Masters and the Knights and the Muslim community to balance work, the manuscript needed to be corrected, the drafts were being prepared, and my schedule. And I must say, I felt so proud of Harrison. And I did tell him jokingly, and it's in the book, that his folk back home in Tennessee would be so proud that here's this young boy managing to deal effortlessly through his courtesy and through his natural enthusiasm in a very difficult circumstance. But the point I wanted to make was that in the midst of this activity, and Frankie had just joined the university to do an MPhil, in the midst of this activity, we'd be working over the weekend, and Pakistanis are very, very hospitable, so there'd be big dinners and lunches, and they have a terrific cuisine, beautiful, very delicious cuisine. And I'd very often tell them on a Saturday night, Frankie and Harrison, you've got a break now. We're going to have dinner. My friends are expecting Zenith and me. And we specifically said we are going to be joined by our young assistants. And they would say, well, we'd love to come, but we have some work to do, and we are going to continue working, and we'll see you next morning, 9 a.m. And that is Sunday morning. Now, whenever you have any doubts about this generation, believe me, this is the generation that's going to take us into the 21st century. And it's critical to know that there are young Americans out there with this kind of dedication and with this kind of capacity to do work under difficult circumstances because they believe in it. Now, I would like to name them, and before I do, I would like to acknowledge their parents, their wonderful parents who have given us these brilliant young kids, and the parents who've come down for this occasion. I know that several of you have come from distances. I know that you've come from Tennessee. Priyanka's parents have come from Pittsburgh. And, of course, Frankie's mom has come from Baltimore, right? Harrison, where is she coming from? Baltimore. Yes, here you are. This senility, I'm mixing the two of you. So here they are, the list. My senior research officers, Harrison and Frankie. And Frankie, I'm thrilled to see, has just flown in from Cambridge. That's the kind of team I'm talking about. This young man is in the middle of his term. Don't tell the tutors at Cambridge. And he flew last night, arrived here, so that he would not miss this launch, because he's been to every public launch of my previous books over the last decade. So here he is. Asia herself, our chief of staff. Priyanka's here, whose poetry is making her so famous that now I'm known simply as Priyanka's professor. And Nafis, part of the team. And here you have someone with an Indian background and someone with a Pakistani background. And if these Indians and Pakistanis can work so well here in Washington, D.C., surely there's a lesson for their peoples over there in South Asia, where they're constantly confronting each other and threatening us with yet another confrontation. Three wars that they've had in South Asia is enough. It's time for peace in South Asia. We have Dylan Kaplan, Peggy, Jamie, and of course, in the back row, I see the great Jonathan Hayden, who used to be with me as my chief of staff. Jonathan, don't think I didn't see you over there. Welcome. So, parents and my team, I would request the wonderful guests of ours to please give them a round of applause. Please stand up first, and I want you to please give them a round of applause, please. Parents and team. Thank you. Thank you. Now, let me get to the substance of this book itself. It begins in a sense, in a very profound sense, on 9/11. When I've just arrived in Washington, D.C., I'm in class. America has been incredibly generous to me, very welcoming to me and my family. And I confront a situation where my class disintegrates. That's the day 9/11, which changed everything. And I realized that if there was one way I could pay back, give back to this great country, it would be to help understanding, to build bridges in my own small, limited way on campus. And that is what I have been doing for most of this decade. Books, articles, television, media, nonstop. It's been a cycle of activity. And it's been a very, very energetic cycle because we are running against a lot of violence, misunderstanding, confrontation, which simply keeps that big gap between Muslims and non-Muslims as wide as ever. All the statistics show that in spite of 10 years of interfaith dialogue and understanding and friendship,
that gap still remains pretty wide. This particular book is the third part of a trilogy. The first book was Journey into Islam. The second, Journey into America, again with my team. In the first one, we went to the Muslim world. In the second one, we traveled in the United States. And this third one takes us into tribal Islam, tribal societies. And we examine 40 tribal societies. We look at the interstices, those parts that are between states, those parts that are between borders, those parts that are often neglected. Martin pointed out the controversial nature of this book, and he's right, because we don't look at these places. We simply look at this monolithic structure of Islam versus the West. We are not seeing these border areas, the tribal areas, the peripheral areas. And these areas have become more or less voiceless. And they're caught up in a confrontation of their own. And that confrontation is between the center and the periphery. Their own central governments, and that history is a long history. It goes back not even decades, it goes back centuries. And the current relationship between the center and the periphery. So we go into great detail. We apply the model that I call the Waziristan model, which is based in my experiences when I was in Waziristan. And then it brings the story up to date to see how and what has changed in Waziristan today. So you see how an anthropologist, which is what I am professionally, can relate the past and the present, create a model, and use it then to understand society today. And the conclusions are both startling, inspiring, frightening, and humbling. And this is where I want you to be involved in this discussion. It is a much more urgent situation than we imagine. Because we don't know about it, we should not assume that there is not a crisis at hand. But for millions and millions of people and their children and their families, there is a crisis. And I hope that America, with its great heart, with its desire for learning and knowledge, will understand and pick up this point and take the argument further, hopefully contributing and changing to the present paradigm. I want to give you a flavor of the book. I'm going to request my team, I'm going to request Harrison to come up here, and four members of my team, and again, we are very conscious of our gender balance in the team. I know the founding fathers, especially Washington and Jefferson, would be very proud of the composition of my team. There's Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, and even Sikh, all represented on my team, so you cannot have a better representation of America today. One or two, I suspect, atheists, but I haven't checked and I haven't asked. Asia, we'll talk about that later. So, Harrison, can you come up and very briefly have the team give us some glimpses of the book as a flavor of the book itself? This is all within my quota of time, so please don't get worried about overshooting any length of time. Come along, Harrison.
Hi, I'm Harrison Akins on Ambassador Ahmed's team. And first of all, I would just like to take this opportunity on behalf of the entire team to say what an honor it has been to work with Ambassador Ahmed on this very important project. So we'll be reading excerpts from the book, The Thistle and the Drone, and I'll begin with its opening lines. The Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. A smiling and confident President Barack Obama told the expectant and glittering audience attending the White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington on May 1st, 2010. Sasha and Malia are huge fans, but boys, don't get any ideas. I have two words for you, predator drones. You'll never see it coming. You think I'm joking? Obama's banter may have seemed tasteless, given that he had just been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But this was not a Freudian slip. The president was indicating he possessed Zeus-like power to hurl thunderbolts from the sky and obliterate anyone with impunity, even an American pop group. One report said he had a love of drones, noting that by 2011, their use had accelerated exponentially. It was also revealed that Obama had a secret kill list, having read St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas and their ideas of the just war and natural law, which promote doing good and avoiding evil, did not deter Obama from a routine of going down the list to select names and nominate them, to use the official euphemism, for assassination. I wondered whether the learned selectors of the Nobel Peace Prize had begun to have second thoughts. As its use increased, the drone became a symbol of America's war on terror. Its main targets appeared to be Muslim tribal groups living in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Incessant and concentrated strikes were directed at what was considered the ground zero of the war on terror, Waziristan, in the tribal areas of Pakistan. There were also reports, however, of U.S. drones being used against other Muslim tribal groups, like the Kurds in Turkey and the Tausug in the Philippines, and also by the United Kingdom against the Pukhtun tribes of Afghanistan, by France in northern Mali against the Tuareg, and even by Israel in Gaza. These communities, some of the most impoverished and isolated in the world, with identities that are centuries old, had become the targets of the 21st century's most advanced kill technology. Next, we have Frankie Martin, who will take you into the heart of our study and the heart of the war on terror, Waziristan, where Ambassador Ahmed had served.
Thank you, Harrison and Dr. Ahmed. 3 decades before President George W. Bush began his manhunt for Osama bin Laden, the most wanted individual on his terrorist list, and hiding among the tribes along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, I had faced a similar challenge, but in a different context and on a different scale. As political agent in charge of South Waziristan Agency, I was tasked with bringing in Sapar Khan, the most wanted man in my area, and an outlaw who was also hiding among the same tribes on the same border as bin Laden. Just as the job Bush held made him the most powerful man in the world, mine made me the most powerful man in the agency. And just as Bush was determined to keep the United States safe and believed bin Laden needed to be captured in order to do so, I believed Sapar Khan needed to be brought to justice for the safety of the agency, although his crimes clearly did not match those of bin Laden. In the end, it was not Bush, but his successor, Barack Obama, who located and killed bin Laden. But it would take a decade of war, costing trillions of dollars, with hundreds of thousands of lives lost and millions displaced. Entire nations would be thrown into turmoil and the world put on high alert. I got my man alive without a single shot being fired. The writ of the government was established, justice served, and the guilty man brought to book. The difference was that I worked entirely within the tribal framework and traditional social structure. Sapar Khan, a Pukhtun from the Mandokel clan, had resorted to an infamous life of crime, raiding, and kidnapping after concluding he had been treated unfairly by the political agent of his agency following a land dispute with a neighboring clan. I had discovered that breaches of law such as shooting at or even kidnapping government officials were sometimes a desperate attempt to draw attention to an imagined or real grievance. It was the equivalent of presenting a written petition for redress to the administration. Sapar Khan was involved in outright criminal acts, however, and had to be dealt with accordingly. But instead of using the military, I negotiated with the tribal elders who saw it as in their own interest to turn over the outlaw. The elders came through, and I was able to bag my man. What I could not imagine for a moment as political agent in the 1970s was that one day an event across the world in the United States would bring a series of unprecedented and unwelcome developments in this very area, that it would become the target of a new kind of weapon. that a new breed of Muslim warriors called suicide bombers would blow themselves up, slaughtering women, children, passengers, and worshippers in mosques, targeting especially the very elders and officials who had helped me apprehend Sapar Khan, that the Pakistan Army, whose officers were seconded to Waziristan to protect its people, would indiscriminately launch a series of invasions on its tribes as if they were a foreign enemy, that Pukhtunwali, the code that defined these tribes and was the core of tribal identity, would be shattered, that Waziristan, so famously inaccessible, would one day become the focus of the world's attention in the first truly global war of the 21st century as Americans pursued an elusive group called Al-Qaeda, and that hundreds of thousands of tribal peoples from this area would be driven out as destitute refugees to live on charity outside the agency, waiting for the time they could return home. The question for all parties involved was how to approach the relationship between the past and the future. That is, how best to apply lessons from the past, if they are apt and suitably adjusted, as guideposts for the future. Problematically, neither the Americans nor the Pakistanis were known for attending to the lessons of history. If they had done so, the Americans would have asked themselves why Afghanistan was called the graveyard of empires and approached it with less arrogance and ignorance. And Pakistanis would not have attempted a military solution in the tribal areas and thus put themselves in danger of repeating their catastrophic handling of East Pakistan. Obviously, neither the Americans nor the Pakistanis were aware, as Corot pointed out in his History of the Pukhtuns, that, quote, no empire of which we have any record has ever succeeded in making subjects of the tribes of Waziristan.
Within this study, we had 40 case studies from Morocco to the southern Philippines, and we looked at their history and their current plight. And next, we'll have Nafis Ahmed recounting some of the horror stories that we discovered in our research, and to also show an often overlooked side of the war on terror, that it has in fact become a war on women.
Because these staggering statistics involve hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, they are numbing and difficult to comprehend. Perhaps individual cases will throw the horror of genocide in sharper relief. Consider the two children in Waziristan who saw their father shot in the head during indiscriminate firing by Pakistani security forces when he took them shopping to a bazaar. The children were covered in blood and brains. They saw their beloved father, head shattered, lying in a pool of blood with no one to help them. For hours, the children sat by the dead body of their father, eyes wide open, not able to cry, not able to speak. Or consider the Fulani Muslims of the Middle Belt region of Nigeria, who became victims of cannibalism by Baroon tribesmen making matter-of-fact comments on video while police watched passively. I want the heart. And did you put some salt? Or hear a Russian soldier describing what his fellow soldiers were doing in Chechnya. One guy pinned a Chechen to the ground with his foot, while another pulled off his pants, and with two or three hefty slashes, severed his scrotum. The serrated blade of the knife snagged the skin and pulled the blood vessels from his body. In a half a day, the whole village was castrated. Then, the battalion moved out. Or listen to Fatoumata, the brave young Fulani woman who relived her ordeal at the hands of security forces chanting, "We are going to exterminate the Fulani," in the notorious episode at the stadium of Conakry, Guinea. A police officer, after raping me, decided to urinate in my mouth. I received streams of urine all over my face. After, they used sticks to rape me. Then, finally, one stabbed me in the front, in my private parts. The blood began to flow, and I was so exhausted that I could not scream or cry. Or hear the courageous Kashmiri woman recalling the night the women of her village were gang-raped by the Indian army. The army entered our houses at 10 p.m. and left at 9 in the morning. There were screams everywhere from almost every house in the village. Or contemplate the bodies of dead Baloch men with lettering carved into their chests declaring, "Long live Pakistan." It is difficult to believe that these are not chronicles and legends of ancient peoples visited by demon barbarians. But what is happening today? People on the periphery have been traumatized beyond imagination in recent years. They have been cooked and eaten. Their women have been gang raped. Their elders and religious leaders have been humiliated, tortured, and killed. Their houses of worship have been destroyed. They have been relocated from their homes, and their lands have been stolen from them. They face widespread famine and disease. They are voiceless and friendless in a hostile world. They have been robbed of their dignity and honor. They have seen their young men and women transformed into suicide bombers, killing innocent women and children, passengers in buses, worshippers in mosques. And yet, the world seems indifferent to their suffering and is barely aware of its scale. This is indeed the dark side of the soul of man. After the grim and relentless litany of woes I have just related, it should give everyone pause to reflect on the fate of humans and ask, is this where we were meant to arrive? In the end, will we be defined by little more than our indubitable capacity to breed and to kill?
And we will conclude with Asia Anderson reading the final lines of the book and pointing the way to peace in the world.
Bright-colored flowers still bloomed in the midst of the dark and bleak battle-scarred landscape. I received one such flower in the form of a message from Mahdi Murad, a young Kurd in northern Iraq who had just performed my allegorical play Noor at the American University in Sulaymaniyah. It was produced by Peter Frederick, a dedicated American professor who inspired his students. We had never met, but Mahdi's heart was overflowing with love as he wrote, "We all prayed for you and expressed our gratitude to you for writing such a great play." Then, from a region plagued by war and genocide, this young student made an offer to a professor safe and secure in Washington, D.C. "Please let me know if I can assist you in any way." Mahdi went on to write not of revenge and honor lost, but of tears and redemption. And in this, he conveyed a message of compassion and love for all. Saddam's missiles and mustard gas and the anarchy of the American invasion could not extinguish the Rumi in Mahdi's heart. As I am writing you this email, my eyes are full of tears. If you could have seen the audience, you would have known that almost everyone lost someone very close to them in a war. I say a war because there have been many of them since the day we were born. However, none of us have ever had the opportunity to cry for the people we have lost. We, Kurds and Arabs in the Noor caste, are joining hands together to shed light of the life of every single person in our country. We gather together to shed our last tears to the sad events our people have experienced so far. We, the cast, stood together as Kurds and Arabs to cry for the innocent sons and daughters we lost. But it would be selfish to just do that. We also cried for the soldiers on all sides who gave their lives. We also cried out against corrupt politicians, greedy businessmen, a cry of warning to everyone who thought someone was evil just because they spoke Kurdish or Arabic or English. We cried for all these things, but most of all, we cried for every Noor in every home, wherever she was. In effect, Mahdi was saying, no more. There must be a different way. Mahdi's tears in search of Noor or light are an apt metaphor to conclude this study. There could be nothing more human than tears of compassion shed in the yearning for illumination. The test is to see a common humanity in the suffering of others. If people can rise above tribe, race, and religion to reach out to others not like them, it will save humankind in the 21st century. It is a daunting task. Perhaps it is necessary to seek guidance from our ancestors and apply their wisdom to the present time. If the world is to become safer, more harmonious, more compassionate, then both the non-Abrahamic and the Abrahamic societies have much to offer. The path to nonviolence and peace shown by the Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist sages, the lessons of the great Guru Nanak of the Sikhs to embrace all humanity, the knowledge of the Jewish savants, and the commandment of Jesus to love one another, and the exhortations of the Prophet of Islam, known to his followers as a mercy unto mankind, to express compassion at all times. All may be combined and reduced to one universal shibboleth, to go out and heal a fractured world. Tikkun olam.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think we're all in shock, Akbar, at that reading. But I think I'd like to just start with a question for you, and then I'm going to bring Sully and Wahid into this. What's your own policy conclusion from this last book? What do you think that President Obama should know and do about what you've discovered on this journey, this long journey that you've taken?
Martin, knowing your own interests and your own intellectual background, I know that you'd zero in on this crucial question. And of course, that is the crux of the study on one level. The answer is the very short answer that he really needs to get the experts like you and offer an alternative paradigm, for you to come up with an alternative paradigm, because this particular paradigm is not working. We've seen it for the last over a decade, and it's just continuing to generate more and more violence. This paradigm that we're offering, looking at those societies, those particular societies, the societies on the periphery, through a tribal frame, offers ways to deal with them. And these ways are based in actual case studies to show it has been done. It's been done over a 200 period. The British were there successfully. There were some other European powers that were not successful because they were trying simply force. And force has very limited use over a length of time. So he's really got to begin to understand that this is a very complicated global situation. It's a long-term solution, and there are no quick fixes, but he really needs to get to that first step, which is to sit down and say, this is not working. I want an alternative which is radical. Now, it's not an easy thing to suggest, and that is the luxury, I think, that we scholars have on campus to think outside the box and come up with answers that hopefully will guide practical policymakers. Because, Martin, again, as a practical, I was an administrator in charge of these areas. Practically, if you spend trillions of dollars and still haven't got peace, if you spend trillions of dollars and you still cannot have one of our citizens, an American, wandering around in Afghanistan or in Pakistan, which are supposed to be allies, these are very close allies of the United States, and we've invested trillions of dollars in these countries, what have we really got out of them? I would like to see a situation where Americans are welcomed as friends, and the investment, in fact, is very apparent in the affection we receive in these societies. And that was true at one stage. And it is true, Martin, through programs, projects like educational ones. I went to a college called Foreman Christian College in Lahore, run by American Presbyterians. It's still very popular in Lahore, still very successful, produced all kinds of presidents and prime ministers and members of parliament. Why can't we have colleges like that in the tribal areas? Colleges which actually promote education, promote an idea of the world which bring people together and really change the direction of society. Because unless that happens, Martin, we are going to continue to see a generation of young tribesmen coming out of this chaos that you read, and you just got the tip of the iceberg through the excellent reading of my team, where you are aware that there's something really huge happening and nothing is being done about it. So I would say this is the short answer. Martin, of course, the longer answer is to ask him to sit down and read the book.
Well, he should certainly do that. Sally, let's bring you into this. What's your reaction to what Akbar has written?
Akbar's book reminds me of a trip that I took 40-some years ago to cover the Shah's celebration in Iran. It was the 2,500th anniversary of the Shah's celebration, and they invited kings and queens from all over the world, and they spent millions and millions of dollars, and everything was imported from France. They didn't have a single Persian dish. And I remember the queen, Faradiba, was very upset because she thought this would have been a perfect time to showcase Persian culture. But in any case, as a young reporter, I was taken by another Persian or Iranian reporter to a private secret meeting, blindfolded. And at the meeting were all these young reporters and protesters, and they all started talking about how the problem with the Shah was that he was evil and he had to be overthrown and that this was going to happen and that there was going to be, you know, a religious revolution and that the Americans didn't understand anything about what was going on in the country. And I was just appalled. So they took me back to my hotel. I took my blindfold off. And the next day, our top foreign correspondent from the Washington Post showed up and I said, John, you know there's going to be a revolution. And I was a beginning party reporter, right? There's going to be a revolution, and the religious people are going to take over. And he sort of patted me on the head and said, there, there, dear. Why don't you just cover your parties and let me handle the foreign policy? And I came back, and my brother, who had just gotten his PhD in religion, was talking about Iran. And he said, because he was a sort of a consultant for the State Department, and he said, they don't have a clue what's going on in Iran. They don't understand it, and they don't understand the religion. They don't get it. And of course, we all know what happens. The Shah was overthrown, and the mullahs came in and took over. And the same thing happened in Iraq. When we went into Iraq, most Americans, and I would venture to say most people in the government, did not know the difference between Sunnis and Shiites. They thought it was going to be a cakewalk, I guess, if it was the expression. But they didn't understand the culture of the country. And we had obviously the same problem in Vietnam going way back. But what Akbar's book is saying over and over and over, and something we should have learned a long time ago, is that we need 100 Akbars in the State Department. We need anthropologists. We need religion experts and people who can understand the culture of a place we're in. I mean, the reason that we are not accepted in Pakistan in the tribal areas is because we don't understand them. We don't have a clue. We think Afghanistan is Karzai. We don't understand that Afghanistan's not Karzai, and that they don't have a relationship with the tribal areas as well. And so, I think that that's one of the biggest issues, and certainly what comes out of your book. And it seems to me, now I'd really like to know whether you think that we did the right thing in going into Afghanistan in the first place. I think most people in this country, even the liberals and pacifists, thought that that was a good thing to go in and bomb Afghanistan after 9/11. Now, looking back, it may not have been the right thing to do. But I'd like to know whether you thought that originally was a good approach.
Sally, I give the answers in a historical context. I think the biggest strategy mistake of us going into Afghanistan was that campaign was based in anger. We went in angry. 9/11 had happened, we were very emotional, someone had to be hit and really hit hard. So we went into this tribal society not knowing what a tribe is, not knowing all the complexities of Afghanistan history, which are complicated enough, not knowing the language, the culture, the clans, and so on. And we got deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into what is clearly a tribal situation. And now 10 years later, we have no idea how to come out of it. Now, let me go back a little bit, and for the sake of the audience...
I'm going to interrupt you for a minute. We do know how to come out of it, which is what the president has decided to do, which is to leave.
Mm-hmm. Martin, that's what he's decided. Let us see whether the history of Afghanistan will allow that or not. That's what the president wants.
Well, that was my question. So what happens to 2014 when we leave?
Martin, if that happens, you have handed over a victory to the Taliban. And that is completely detrimental to American interests. The Americans must stay, but stay differently. Again, the emphasis has to shift from the military to culture, to reaching out, to making friends, to education, which is what the Afghans want, which is what the Pakistanis want. And let me make the point here, Martin, that, again, I don't want to be projecting or promoting a simplistic analysis, pro this government or pro that government or pro this people or pro that people. I'm simply trying to reach for the best solution. And Sally, we are talking about your own reactions in that part of the world. Now, going back to the examples I give in the book on Waziristan, and I'm going back to British times, and I know it's not a good or a popular thing for an American audience to hear quotations from the Imperial British, but Martin... We'll have to...
We tend to think that they screwed it up just as badly as we did.
They did. They did, Martin. But in this case, with the political officers, it was a brilliant masterstroke of administration. It really was, and it's undisputed. Now, let me tell you what happened when I met Sir Olaf Karo, one of the legendary officers of the Frontier Province. And I'm delighted his son, Michael, is sitting here. Michael, welcome. Delighted to see you. Now, Sir Karo spoke Pashto. In fact, the great classic, The Pathans, the book on the Pathans, the definitive book, is written by Sir Olaf Karo. And when I met Sir Evelyn Howell at Cambridge in the mid-60s, Sally, who was political agent in Waziristan 50 years before then, just think of the link I'm giving you, at the high noon of the British Empire, Sir Evelyn Howell had asked me to see him. I was a young student, completely unaware of my own culture and my own history. And he said, I want to talk to you about Khushal Khan Khattak, one of the greatest Pashto poets, because he was translating his work. My question to you, Sally, we've gone into Afghanistan. How many Americans spoke Pashto, translated Pashto poetry, interacted with it? It was doomed from the start. You cannot appear in a land and abuse people and humiliate them and dismiss their culture and then expect them to love you. In an environment where dignity and honor matter gravely. Martin, we could request Muayyad to comment
yes,
on this at
exactly.
this stage.
Thank you.
Akbar, first of all, I want to thank you for writing this book and trying to give voice to the voiceless. I think that in this book you have transcended the tribalism, which is sometimes hardwired in a psyche. But alongside the conflict you are mentioning between the periphery and the center, there's another conflict which is emerging, an outgrowth of that. That is between the elite and the street. The elites were traditionally seen as at the center, and the streets were seen as in the margins. But what is happening now is that the elites are getting marginalized, and the street is now coming into the center. Why? Because I think there's a fatal flaw in Western policy which has never been tested. That feeling is okay, very simplistic. Let's install, foist, promote, and foster so-called moderates. And these moderates, once they are installed, they're going to foil militancy. That's the conventional thinking. In fact, in theory, I've seen that because I was in the cabinet, I was advisor to the Prime Minister also. In fact, the very installation of and promotion of these moderates have enhanced radicalism. Because there is no moderation in their pursuit of the quick buck. And the so-called democracy, the fixation with the label of democracy, not on its content, what is happening is it's a combo of plutocracy and kleptocracy. The rule of the super rich, what the Pope Francis has said, the imperialism of big money, and the rule of thieves, like something like the lure of Robin Hood during the time of King John. So what to do? I think first of all, as Martin Indyk said, well, let's be very honest. Instead of fighting futile conflicts, let's attack the two issues which are at the center of the fueling of radicalism. Regionally, it's Kashmir. And Kashmir is not a ski resort. If you look at the New York Times of Sunday, there's a big, huge travel article depicting Kashmir as a ski resort. It's not a ski resort. And then handling the issue of Palestine. I think it's one of the key sources of global militancy. There has to be, I think, an attack on that. And I was very pleased, actually, to see, because I have come to the conclusion, and this is a conclusion shared by a lot of people, that America has lost the war on terror. Period. What to do now? I think one remarkable documentary came from Israel, The Gatekeepers. I suggest that everybody in this room should see that. These are six heads of the Shin Bet who have gone through the surface furnace, heed what they have said. They realize that this route of crackdown, of brutality, of not talking, is basically putting Israel on the road to perdition. And they see, these people who know, they're not theoreticians, not academics, not just think tank pundits. They are dealing with it practically. They feel that the future is very, very bleak for Israel itself. And there has to be a change of course. And I feel that you mentioned about FC College. I think that we have given people, we talk of martyrs, we have given people enough reason to die. People who are not afraid of death cannot be deterred. I promise you that, with the use of force. That further fuels that. Give them a reason to live now. Do something so that they feel that there's no need to blow themselves up. We went to, Akbar and I were privileged to go to Foreman Christian College, set up by American Presbyterians, occupiers, 1864 at the peak of the Civil War, when Lincoln was the president. They were the occupiers of the heart, the conquerors of the heart. And if you go to a very quiet corner of a Lahore cemetery on Jail Road, they occasionally have gone to pay homage to my American teachers, that in most of their tombstones, it's written the parting dictum of St. Paul, that I stayed the course, I kept the faith, and I fought the good fight. I think most importantly, we should not quit giving up the good fight. Often I've seen in Washington that people throw away their hands. That's it. And it's very interesting. You see more conformity, more fear of breaking away from the group thing than you see in countries like Pakistan, where your convictions are tested. So I think the time has come, what Hazrat Ali had said, my final comment. He said there are 2 days of destiny, the great saint. One day destiny is for you, one day destiny is against you. When it's for you, as it was for America after the collapse of the Soviet Union, do not be proud. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Akbar, I want to focus on a related aspect that grows out of the discussion we've just been having here, which is President Obama's drone policy. Because in effect, to simplify it, what we have here in terms of the U.S. approach, United States approach to the challenges that you're describing in the relationship between the United States and tribal Islam, is the exact opposite of what you're suggesting we should do. We're in fact drawing away from engagement on the ground to engagement from the air to try to achieve a kind of surgical extraction or elimination of the jihadist elements that attacked us on 9/11 and still see the United States as the enemy. So what is the impact? Because I think you speak about this in the book very compellingly, but what is the impact of that policy on these, what you call the ungovernable areas, what we've come to call the empty spaces, though of course they're not empty at all. But what is the impact of this elevation of drone warfare in the war on terror?
Martin, first of all, again, I want to really thank you and Brookings for allowing us to talk about it, because we hear so much there is a debate about drones in the United States. It's not a debate. We're just hearing one side of a discussion, which is justifying the drone in terms of keeping us safe, keeping boots off the ground, and so on. A debate is two opposing ideas presenting themselves in the form of a discussion, in the form of a dialogue, and then some conclusion emerging from that. We really need to hear people from the other side. We need to talk to people from the tribal areas of Pakistan or where the drones are being used, on the impact it's having there. Now, you use the word surgical, Martin, and I believe that there can be something as something that can be described as surgical. That's the theory. But in practice, Martin, think of it. If you're sitting in a little settlement in the tribal areas of Pakistan, we're talking of huge areas with millions of people involved, and wife, husband, family having dinner, lunch. Across the world, someone presses a button, and for some reason, you're blown up. We know that it's not surgical. We know that study after study, the Stanford study, New York University study, studies coming out from the tribal areas confirm that with every one intended target, you may have 5, 10, 15, 100 unintended. Now that once, twice, an apology, mistake has been made, could be acceptable locally. But this is happening with such alarming frequency that it has reached and gone beyond the red lines of tolerance in that part of the world. So today you kill one man who's anti-American and you add 100,000 who become anti-American. So you are crossing out one, and they then in the other ledger you're adding 100,000. And in the process you're feeding into the, I would say now, furnace of anti-Americanism, both in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other parts of the world, which did not exist. I want to remind the audience that in a country like Pakistan, we have a picture in the last book that Bob published of Jackie Kennedy visiting Pakistan, visiting Lahore, standing in an open car with the president of Pakistan, Sally, and she's a beautiful woman. The president was a very smart, handsome man. And the two of them are in an open car surrounded by hundreds of smiling, laughing Pakistanis throwing flower petals at them. Now, Sally, think and picture to yourself any American today standing in any car in Lahore, what would they be throwing at him?
Probably not tomatoes.
And not flower petals. So what has happened? We have to ask ourselves. The same Jackie Kennedy goes to the Khyber Pass, same tribesmen we are talking about, Martin. And the tribal chiefs actually give her a grand reception. They have all kinds of meats and feasts prepared for her and welcome her in the Khyber Pass. So America has, as I said, Martin, in answer to your earlier question, a role to play. It is a world leader. It has a vision of the world. It has a vision of promoting a society that is democratic, civil liberties, human rights issues. These are American values, and they are being lost in this war on terror as is being conducted. So for taking out 5, 10, 15, whatever number of people we have to take out, we are losing much, much more. And as one of our blurbers said, Colonel Wilkerson, who was chief of staff of Colin Powell, he said, Harrison, do you have the exact quote? I'd like you to stand up and read it if you can get a copy of the book. He wrote, Martin, a beautiful, almost poetic, I'd like you to hear this. This is the chief of staff of Secretary Colin Powell, an army man, and he gave us this blurb about the strategy. Martin, with your permission.
Yeah, this is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. In the end, like the Kurdish observers of Nur and Soleimani in the book, I was close to tears. Lagrimas caudales, or flowing tears, to use the apposite phrase of Blas de Otero, seems to be what the book's conclusions lead to. This is particularly true if, like me, you have been very, very close to the center of decision-making in the U.S., and you know how incapable it is of embracing such sophisticated reasoning, let alone developing and applying strategies in accordance with such reasoning. Thus, lagrimas for the tribes, for the soldiers, and for the United States. If one extrapolates from Professor Ahmed's findings and from the history of torture as well, bug splat, as the victims of drone strikes are called, and torture live in the same house. Ahmed makes clear that, like torture, the creation of such profound fear wounds the creators as well, destroying their liberties, polluting their democracy, and devouring their souls. Professor Ahmed gives us the only way out of this dangerous dilemma, a way to coexist with the thistle without the drone.
Do you see, Martin, the average person there, the household head, the mother of so many children, the head of the family, they are being struck one day by the drone, the next day by their own army looking for terrorists, the third day by suicide bombers blowing themselves up. You know, they may belong to one religious ideology or another. The next day by tribal rivals. It's sheer hell there. And as they say, every day is like 9/11 for us. Now, unless we have some modicum of stability in those societies, the impact is then felt on the larger nation. And the larger nations are now in turmoil. So that today in countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, you have a situation where these suicide bombers are walking into schools, into buses, into offices, and blowing themselves up. This has never happened in the history of those areas. How are we able to stop them? Where are the drones? How effective are the drones? Where is the success of the surgical strikes? I would go back again to the much simpler philosophy of the old officers on the frontier, the political officers who could get to the source of the problem and control it. I'm not saying ignore it. I'm not saying ignore the bad guys, but deal with them effectively. That's all I'm saying.
Pakbar, do you think that there's any role at all for drones in the tribal areas?
Not the way they're being implemented, Sally.
Any other way?
Right now, it's almost blind. We're just going, you know, bang, so-and-so's a bad guy. And you blow him up, 100 people blown up alongside that. And that's feeding into, in Pakistan, Afghanistan, the very anti-American feeling. It's reached, I would say, Sally, I hate to use the word, almost pathological now. In Pakistan, for example, people will tell you, I've heard this, that the floods that came to the country a year or two back were engineered by the Americans. The civil plane that crashed north of Islamabad, killing 300 passengers, organized by the Americans because they wanted to fly it into Pakistan's nuclear program. That's the kind of thinking that's taken over in a country which is potentially our ally. And again, we have to say, all right, do we want to simply lose this so that we kill 5 or 10 or 15
so-called bad guys. There must be a cheaper, more effective way. I don't know, Mohit, do you want to comment
on
this?
Can I just say one thing here, yes, please, just to provoke you. But, you know, this is we talk about Pakistan. This is the country that was hosting Osama bin Laden. Okay, so, I mean, it's not total blame on the United States side here.
No, right? But Martin, as I said,
and in the tribal areas, there are tribal leaders. And what are they doing in this to stop what is happening within their own tribal societies?
Again, very important question, Martin. Important questions. First of all, the tribal leaders. 400 have been killed. So it's like an entire society decapitated. That's where they are.
Killed by
the suicide bombers. So they've been killed. They've been removed. So you have a vacuum in society. Now, when you have a vacuum and you as a superpower are saying, we want to be effective in those areas, we want to remove the bad guys and still have some influence, do you think it's good strategy then to say, okay, it's on fire, let it burn? Pour some more gasoline, which is the drones, or to bring some modicum of stability, because that tribal leadership that you're pointing to has been removed, is decapitated, number one. Number two, as far as the notion of they're to blame and we're to blame, I'm really, Martin, in this book, stepping back. So I'm not looking at it as America's point of view or Pakistan's point. I'm not representing any country. Although when we were in the United Kingdom, Martin, this is a pleasant aside, Harrison, Frankie, and I would very often face huge audiences in the UK where, as you know, unfortunately, America is not always the most popular of foreign powers from a time when it was very much the favorite country. But there's lots of controversy about foreign policy and so on. And we had to actually face all these questions from the other side. They'd say, you Americans are doing this, and you Americans are, and we'd say, look, we are just visiting scholars. We are not representing the embassy. So we've got to step back one and look at it clinically and not see it in terms of is this in this country's interest or that. Because if you begin to do that, then once again, we are using ideology to come to conclusions. And that has failed. That's failed to bring law and order in these areas. And that's the big takeaway. Yes.
I think finally you have to look at the scorecard, whether the drones have helped America or they have hurt America, whether they have reduced radicalism or whether they have enhanced. I think very clearly it has diminished America, it has enhanced anti-Americanism, and even here, because the language of extreme is the same everywhere. You can be a person with a beard and robe, you can be a three-piece suited person with a pinstripe robe speaking fluent English. The language of extremism is the same. Even here, there's been a tremendous rise of Islamophobia. Anybody who has watched the Republican debates, I think it's stunning to see the language used against Islam and Muslims. And insofar, I think there's been an erosion of common sense, erosion of common decency, erosion of common civility. So, talking of Osama bin Laden, I think let's be honest also, let's go back. Osama bin Laden was brought there with the help of the Arab establishment, facilitated by Pakistan, also with the blessing of America. One can't just distance itself away from the consequences. When you give a medicine, one should be, a good doctor knows, first of all, a diagnosis, and the side effects. These are one of the side effects of that. And I think that shows that policies were never fully vetted. I just saw a snippet of a very interesting documentary.
But what is Pakistan's responsibility in this?
Pakistan
doesn't get mentioned in your litany of Pakistan, who's responsible.
If you have read my writings, I have been brutal critic of Pakistani political culture and the path Pakistan is taking. I think this kind of setup in Pakistan is not the answer. This kind of democracy is not the answer. The results are quite clear. The leadership in America in handling this issue has not delivered. The so-called leadership, I called in Pakistan, they are office bearers. They're not leaders. Leaders give a vision. Leaders inspire confidence in the people. Leaders don't induce despondency. So they have not delivered. So that's why I feel that a time has come to change course. And this is why I was referring to this documentary of the gatekeepers. And I also want to refer to another documentary, which is going to be released tomorrow. The World According to Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney was asked this question that, have you any faults? And you know, for 10 seconds his head slumped. He said, my faults? After 10 seconds, he said, I don't spend a lot of time reflecting on my faults. So this is what Confucius said.
He's not the only
one. Somebody, three fingers are pointing at yourself. We need to self-reflect. We need to identify, rectify, and correct the path of what is self-destructive. And that's the path. And it's completely doable. Because Even look at South Africa. Let's give credit to de Klerk. He realized that the status quo would destroy South Africa. And he realized that we have to open dialogue with Mandela. De Gaulle also, to his credit, realized that Algeria is consuming the soul of France. He decided to quit Algeria. So there is statesmanship which is lacking.
Sally, let's talk for a moment about the dimension of women in this conflict. Because Akbar, again in the book, focuses on the way in which this combination of all of these violent forces, especially in tribal societies where honor is and is such a an important value, is having a devastating effect on women.
Well, you know, I was about to bring up religion, and what fascinates and baffles me is the seemingly acceptance of Muslim against Muslim. I mean, who are all these suicide bombers blowing up? They're blowing up other Muslims. And, you know, an American can be criticized for destroying the Quran, but if you're blowing up a mosque, you're destroying a lot of Qurans. But I don't think you can separate out the issue of women and religion, because one of the reasons that women are devalued in these tribal societies is because of their religious views. I mean, it's cultural, but it's also religious. We can talk forever about women's rights and all of that, but I think until the society is better educated, and we know how difficult that is, we've seen what's happened recently with this young woman, Malala, who stood up for women's education. But I think until women are educated, you're not going to have much improvement in women's status. And I think one of the reasons women are not educated is because the religion, particularly not Islam, I'm not speaking about Islam forever, because we all know that in certain societies, education is valued. But I think that the role of women in religion really means that they stay at home, they take care of their families, and they don't get educated. And so it's kind of like which comes first, the chicken or the egg. I mean, you have to educate the women in order to improve their role in society, but how do you educate them if the religion keeps them down?
Well, Sally, this is a very important issue you've raised, and Martin, I'm grateful you asked about this. The situation, especially in tribal societies, is dire. And you're absolutely right. If it is so bad for ordinary people, think of it for the women. The statistics for the tribal areas, which we quote in the book, Sally, for literacy, women, is zero. Just think of an entire society where zero. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that women don't want to be educated? Now, let me give you the other side of the story. In Swat, where the Taliban had taken over till a few years ago, one of the first things the Taliban did was to destroy or close the girls' schools. Now, why did they have girls' schools in a place where the Taliban closed them? Because the former ruler of Swat, the Wali of Swat, had created something like 300 free girls' schools for women, free girls' schools. And I remember him showing me the convent, because he was my wife's grandfather. He had created a convent. He had requested the nuns from the convent where they studied, his family, the girls, to open a convent school in Swat, which the nuns did. And that was his prize. And of course, the first thing the Taliban did was to blow it up. So what does this mean, Sally? Are they giving up? No, the women of Swat, the women of Pakistan, the women of Afghanistan are the real heroes in the story. Because you mentioned Malala, they've been working with my wife's family. In fact, Nafis was there last year. Nafis, do you want to comment on women? Because we don't want to give the impression women have given up education in your part of the world. Do you want to make a comment on that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's wait for the microphone if there is one. Or why don't you come up and speak here? Why don't you speak at the podium?
And there are, Sally, 70 members of parliament who are women. So, you know, they have, I totally agree, their rights are denied, inheritance and so on, they're being treated. But they're fighting back. They're at the cutting edge of this debate about society and modernity, and they need all the support we can give them.
Well, I'm not a terrible expert on this matter at all, but I have worked in Swat, Pakistan for about 2 summers, and as an American woman, you could imagine that it would be quite difficult to work there, but I visited so many young girls' homes and so many schools, and I saw this incredible passion to be educated and to learn, and a lot of them found this desire to be educated and to learn and to better themselves from their religion. And a lot of them do have backing from their homes. I actually just heard a BBC episode on this young woman in Waziristan who has become a world-renowned squash player because her father and her family supported her. And I think it goes back to the issue of the drones, where if you have things like this that are totally disabling and ruining societies, you curb the opportunities for women like this to rise and to show their true potential to the world. And so I have seen this this desire to learn, to be educated, and I think that it just needs backing from their societies.
Thank you. I still think it's a bit of a stretch to say that drones are responsible for the lack of education of women.
But no, I don't think
it's a bit of a stretch.
But what I'm interested in is the different view between the men in these tribal areas and the women in terms of education.
The men are
and
men
their
are,
religious views.
Sally, there's, and you know, I'm not taking sides. I'm not justifying. It is unacceptable the way they behave with their women, especially in tribal societies. Traditionally, they don't have a voice in the jirga. Traditionally, very often, the brothers don't give inheritance to the women. That's not Islam. You know, you keep confusing Islam and tribalism. This is tribal Islam.
No, I don't.
No, but you know, it is generally confused. But under Islam, as you know, Sally, there are laws of inheritance for females given in the 7th century and other rights. Now, those are not given them. So the situation of women is dire. But again, women today are aware of their rights. And they're not just taking it lying down, they're fighting back and they're demanding it. And the examples that you're hearing are examples of very inspiring, especially the young generation of women going out there and demanding this and getting it. I mean, they're also getting it. There's an environment now, in spite of all the chaos and the violence. Now, the drone, Martin, is not responsible for this, but when you have a fire burning in the house, anything that adds to the heat is not good for the promotion of causes like you and I may want. You know, women's rights, education, compassion. You're talking of simply interfaith dialogue, for example. Sally, you may remember Nafisa's elder sister, Dr. Ahmed Hoti, was the first director of the only Jewish Muslim center at Cambridge University. And that center had been opened by the chief rabbi in the UK, who's a great patron of Amine. Amine went back to Pakistan with her husband and started the first female interfaith movement in Pakistan. You published an article in the Post last year. Now, she's out there. I mean, this is a woman who's actually promoting interfaith dialogue for women. So she could be sitting very comfortably in Cambridge. In fact, Zenith and I are constantly worried about her being in that environment. But they're not giving up, sadly. She's not listening to her parents. So she's saying, this is my battle. I'm out here and I'm going to face this.
Let's go to the audience. My goodness. There are microphones here. And you need to wait for the microphone after I call on you. Please identify yourself, and please ask a question. As you can see, we've got some very talented people, especially Akbar, who can answer your questions, but you need to ask a question.
Can we wait just for 1 second? Because Akbar didn't finish answering the question about Muslim against Muslim.
Yes, yes.
Do you want to?
Yes.
Okay.
And Sally, again, there's a whole discussion in my book on this very issue. Because how can a Muslim... To me, it makes absolutely no sense. There's no justification for violence to start with. You know, I condemn that. That's not Islam. But then when you have a Muslim walking into a mosque and blowing himself up and killing 200 worshippers, what sense is there in that? And yet that's happening. And yet somehow they're justifying it. Now, the only way I, as an anthropologist, as a former administrator, can explain it, you cannot justify it, you have to condemn it at all counts, explain it is that it is working within a code that to that individual, as Mohaid said, there's no reason for that individual to live. Everything has been lost. So that person is functioning under some kind of mutated, distorted code of revenge. And that's what's
been... Hang on a minute. Somebody sends that suicide bomber.
Not always, Martin. That's what we've analyzed.
They've got to get bombs. Where do they get the bombs
Martin,
from?
Martin, those people are living in societies that have fought empires.
People who commit suicide out of despair is one thing. People who strap bombs around their body and go into a mosque to kill innocent worshippers is another. And somebody is sending them up.
Yes, and the people who are sending them are organized. They're behind them. But they also are violating the code of Islam, which does not permit this. So they themselves are involved. And these are the small groups that we are talking about. And we have to contain them. Because unless we contain them, Martin, this business of promoting women or education is in the end going to be reduced to naught. Because you set up a school, they'll come and blow it up. They're terrorizing. Well, just take Malala Yousafzai's example. They shot her. She was flown to the UK. She became an instant, very well-deserved recognition internationally. And what do the Taliban say? They say when she comes out, we're going to try again. We won't let her go.
I just want to add one very quick footnote. First of all, drones are a weapon of convenience. And weapons of convenience, I think, have a short shelf life like marriages of convenience. So that's the basic...
Now, why don't say Muslims allow four wives?
secondly,
we could have drugs responsible for...
Secondly, on the issue of terror, you know, it's absolutely right. It's a terrorism when you tie a thing. But I think we have to depoliticize the issue of terrorism. State terror, group terror, individual terror has to be put on the same level. It's a crime against humanity. It should be attacked frontally.
Thank you. My goodness. Let's have a woman first, down here with the blue scarf on. Please identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Natalie Khvalish. I work at Center for International Policy, just two doors down. I wrote my master's thesis, actually, on hybrid state building in Afghanistan. And your discussion raised a question that I posed myself, which is, you mentioned the elders are so much under attack, and Afghanistan has been at war for two decades. In a lot of areas, those traditional institutions have degraded. The young generation in the Pashtun South has often been educated in Islamic schools in Pakistan. They come back and with very little respect for the traditional elders. And I was wondering, what is, in your opinion, a way to peace when both the central states can't provide, but the traditional institutions are also not there anymore or can't really provide?
Natalie, this question has been covered in great detail in my book because I go back, I take the full sweep of history from the time I was there in the late 70s when the Soviets entered Afghanistan. So I trace that trajectory, how this begins to impact and change society. And you're absolutely right that if you took the pillars of authority, the religious leadership, the tribal leadership, government authority, all those pillars have been slowly demolished. You know, the tribal elders you were talking about, Martin. They've all been removed. They've been destroyed. Now, in that vacuum, you do have the emergence of these suicide bombers. They're organized in small groups or large groups, but they're there. They're a reality, and they're blowing up things. They're causing destruction, and they're really paralyzing society. You cannot function when you have that kind of repeated violence. What do you do about it? First of all, you understand the problem. We are not understanding it here in the United States, the superpower of the world, with all the facilities we have here. How do you expect Islamabad or Kabul to understand it? Those bureaucrats are really a pale reflection of our bureaucrats here. They are not understanding the problem also. There's a very limited understanding of the center periphery in terms of the capital cities of the developing world. That's what I found. So if you talk to the bureaucrats in Islamabad or Kabul, they will look at it very differently. They'll blame... For example, let me give you one example. When I interviewed people for this study and my team was with me and they saw this and we were amazed. When we talked to Americans, senior Americans, and we said, who do you think is responsible for the TTP, the Taliban, the people who are causing the violence? And without a moment's hesitation, they said, Pakistan. So we said,
fine, because it's a study, it's an anthropological study, we put it down, keeping the sources anonymous. Then we asked Pakistanis, senior people, ambassadors, generals, and so on, who do you think is responsible for the TTP? Without a moment's hesitation, Natalie, what did they say? Americans. Now, when it's that bad, when this fog of war is so thick that two allies aren't able to even come to the conclusion as to who is causing the problem, you have a problem. And you've really got to, first of all, begin the process of sitting down and saying, well, here's the problem. This is what we're going to do about it. We are not even recognizing that there is a problem. There is a problem. When I talk about women not having their rights, that's the issue Sally raised, or the suicide bombers blowing up things, that is a problem. It's not a normal society. And as Mohaid said, if the government itself is seen as it is seen in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, as corrupt, as incompetent, as clueless, how are we going to solve the problems that are creating this situation of, I would say, like a house on fire? So Afghanistan itself, the first answer is to start rebuilding those structures that can then contain this violence. And that those structures have not been built yet.
Okay. Question here. The gentleman in the red tie.
I just wanted to make a correction.
Please identify yourself.
I'm Fazan Ilic. About that big party the Shah had in Persepolis, there was one item from Iran. It was beluga caviar. The greatest historical...
You're right.
The greatest historical irony was that
the Shah's golden caviar.
The Shah was allergic to caviar, and he had to settle for something a little less exotic.
But he gave his golden caviar to his closest friend.
So,
what is golden caviar?
It's the most rare form. It's a pale sort of gold color, and it's unbelievably delicious.
Can we get to the question, please?
So I feel like there's a sense of desperation and paralysis in this town that is the cause. This is the symptom. They just don't know what to do. There must be a cheaper way. We would assume that is doing sustainable development. We haven't figured out how to do it. The entire establishment is incapable of producing results. I think... The paradox is that if people are qualified, they won't be able to find a job. And the Beltway bandits who piss away this money year after year, and we know they're not producing.
Is this a question?
That's the question.
I think it was a statement.
Can I ask that
do
as
you
a
have
question?
A question?
Yes, I
please.
Do. And I want to get very Stefan Richter with the Globalist. I want to get to the policy question that the two of you had at the beginning. When you asked what are the policy precepts, consequences, and so on. And in what has been a rather depressing but brilliant afternoon, I think the question behind this is the following. Akbar, you started the answer with, despite the trillions spent. Americans are very smart people. They're extremely well educated. The only logical conclusion with everything that you've attested to through your research is that it can't be despite, because anybody can conclude that it makes no sense. But there must be a political economy in play because we need to spend the billions and a trillions. And I'm not having just a discussion on the Pakistan situation, but even newspapers like the Wall Street Journal have put it on their front page that 90% of all development aid expended by USAID and the United States government rests within the Beltway, which is a surefire way of never getting anything done around the world. Thank you.
I'm not sure we had a question there, but do you want to respond to this?
That wasn't a question.
development aid, why can't we do this?
Why can't we be more effective about development?
Yeah, but that's what I've been saying, similar through education and so on, yeah.
True, yeah, okay. All right. Let's go down the back, please. Woman with the in the black. Yes.
Sorry. Hi, my name is Fatma Saidi. I'm a student from Afghanistan. Actually, I don't have a particular question, but I was so surprised that here that you said that what is the solution now for Afghanistan and you said we have a solution because Obama said that we want to come out. And Michael, like, it is a question, but I want to know your view. What you think is Afghanistan? Is it a laboratory of practicing your weapons? With all the respect that I have for Americans. But please do not make the mistake that you did with Mujahideen, because it is not that Afghanistan anymore. Now people in Afghanistan, they know their rights. And you know that if this happened, if America leave now Afghanistan, Afghanistan will destroy the world. Because people in Afghanistan, they become more, I don't know, they become more in a way that they are more dangerous now. So I would like to know your idea. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Martin, I think that was for you. She's saying, don't send the drones.
Well, I'm moderating this discussion, but if the question was for me, I would simply say that what I was trying to say before was not that we have a solution, but that our failure to achieve a solution is leading to a view in the United States that I think is broadly held across political lines that nothing good can be done in this situation, that the best thing we can do is get out of there. I think there is at the moment a commitment to stay till 2014 and to keep funding the effort of the Afghan government and the Afghan army that has been trained up in the meantime to maintain order there in the hope that Afghan lives and society can be rebuilt. But I think it's a very big question mark whether the American people will continue to support that kind of funding after 2014. And if that goes away, then I'm afraid we're going to see a repeat of what happened when the Soviet Union withdrew. And the Taliban will indeed end up taking over again. So I'm quite concerned that it becomes very important to maintain support in this country for a continued American engagement after the troops are withdrawn. And that's where your argument, Akbar, becomes all the more important, because then we're going to have to rely on things other than boots on the ground.
Martin, I completely agree, because again, stepping back, this is the area of what was called the Great Game in the 19th century. The great game between Imperial China, Imperial Russia, Imperial Britain, right? The United States is there now. The United States, Martin, to my mind, this, I'm looking at it from my part of the world, cannot pack up and leave. It just cannot, because if it leaves, it leaves a huge vacuum. That is where it's all happening. You've got China on one side, you've got Russia on the other, India in the south, you've got the Arab world in the west, Iran in the west. How can the United States just pack up and leave? And yet, when we talk about how successful this whole exercise has been, we have the president of Afghanistan, set up by the Americans, actually saying that the United States and the Taliban are my two biggest problems. I mean, there's something very wrong here, Martin. This is almost like a Shakespearean tragedy or comedy. I'm not sure what it is. Sally, please.
No, but you can't blame Americans for saying, well, let's just...
No.
Give it up.
You have to then explain to them why that cannot happen. It's against the interest of America itself.
Getting now, as you pointed out recently, we're now getting into Africa, and we're getting into the same mess in Africa.
Absolutely.
We're easing in with
Classic.
Mali and all over, and General Rodriguez testified, as you have pointed out, and didn't come up with any new solutions. So here we are getting out of Afghanistan, but maybe not, and now we're entering
charging
into another area.
But,
I think what the mistake was made was giving the deadline of 2014. That became a millstone around the neck. And I think it didn't make any strategic sense, because on one hand, the United States is asking the Afghan security, government, army to make an unlimited commitment while limiting its own, commitment. I think that was a significant mistake. The second mistake pertaining to your book, Drones, that my friend Shahzad Chaudhary just showed me a clipping of the Washington Post, which shows that the Pentagon has already minted a medal of Distinguished Warfare Medal given to drone operators, which would be a higher rank than the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. So this shows how the lives are going to be weighed of innocents in the rest of the world, particularly in the tribal areas.
Okay. Let's have a question down the back there. Gentleman with the mustache.
My name is Titus Pressler.
Wait for the microphone, please.
My name is Titus Pressler. I'm the current principal of Edwards College in Peshawar.
Welcome, Titus. Welcome.
Pantunkwa.
We all old Edwards College boys, welcome.
A sister college to Foreman Christian College.
Yes, and we live just next to it.
And so I very much appreciate your encouragement of culture and education. And yet at the same time, I share the anguish of a college like Edwards trying to do its part, like Foreman Christian College, regarded as a kind of island of moderation and enlightenment. This year we have inaugurated the Integrity Project, dealing with some of the salient issues of Pakistani society: gender respect, diversity tolerance, community responsibility, servant leadership. And yet we find within this island of enlightenment.
And I presume you're being sarcastic.
Yes. Yes, a constant tendency, anytime the issue of religion comes up, a hypersensitivity, anytime the issue of community responsibility or gender respect comes up, a hypersensitivity among students who come from, in fact, some of the elite families. And at that level of culture, what do you see happening in Pakistani society that is drawing some of the best and the brightest, not towards the ideals that you're espousing, but in fact away from them?
Well, Titus, that's of course the great challenge that you face, the educations like you. And again, I want to salute you in public. You are the real heroes for me. I have had the privilege of knowing your college. My relative studied in it. We lived just next to Edwards College for many years. And I've had the privilege of meeting Dr. Tebe, your counterpart, who heads Foreman Christian College. You are actually creating an entire generation and sustaining it in a certain direction. Your problem, as I see it, is this, that for every one step you're taking forward and trying to move towards that vision, every time there's a religious riot, someone burns the Quran here in the United States, or there's a drone strike, it doesn't make your task easier. Am I right? And what happens then? Then you're facing greater resistance within society. Won't it be far greater help to you if you had some help from Washington? And that help can only come if they are aware of the issues. So far, there's a disconnect between you as an American on the ground and the Washington policymakers. That is, Martin, what I'm trying to point out, that connect. And if that connect can happen, things can change. Because Americans have been traditionally, and I've grown up in that part of the world, very popular with ordinary people. It's the last couple of years that's really ruined that reputation. Why can't that happen again? As Mohit said, we looked up to and we loved our teachers. We had great respect for them. They represented this great civilization. And today they're so hated that they can't be wandering around in the streets.
But I think, Akbar, you're making this point that there's knowledge here, but there's little wisdom. Yeah. I think if you have knowledge and there's no wisdom, it's like a car without a steering wheel or a brake, you know.
The gentleman here.
And we use this phrase, Zamoyed, in the book.
Yeah.
We said every kind of information is available. Yeah. No understanding. Yeah.
I'm Mohammed Kasim. I have actually two questions. Last year, Don Leone Panettone, when he was capo di capi at CIA, said there are only 50 Al-Qaeda and they're all in Pakistan. And then there was the other warlord, General James Jones. He said, oh, no, there are 100, 50 in Pakistan and 50 in Afghanistan. Now, they're so precise, these two top warlords, about the numbers. How do you expect the drone fellows to be even more precise? And then you get a figure like 49 innocents killed against one supposed target. The other thing, I'm an economic historian, getting a bit old, but what I find is that empires expand, empires retreat. And they expand, conquered lands divide and rule, and rule to divide. And when that power retreats, those break up. And all the European empires, Africa and Europe and Asia, are going through that. Now, the inheritance is with the exceptional empire, the United States. And it is really screwing up. Can you observe it from that point of view?
Sandy, you want to
respond? It's for you, Akbar.
I'm not sure whether it's a question or a comment.
Well, it's a comment.
Yeah, it's a comment.
It's a comment. It's a comment. We're talking about the rise and fall of empires, right?
Let's try over here.
I'm not sure where this question is going. Are you talking about redrawing those boundaries? Or?
Yes, I think it's a public problem.
So would you like to help redraw them? I think it would be great if you can have more peace in the area. But I don't see it happening in my lifetime.
I'm getting a bit too old. I know no answers anymore.
I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime or my daughter's lifetime. So I think we should leave that alone for the time being.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stern. Worked with Ambassador Ahmed and our colleague John Maluski on a play about his life and times, Waziristan to Washington. So back to Waziristan, and maybe looking backward to some lessons. I mean, I think in this discussion we realize that it's not an intact thistle hit by the drones. The thistle has been vastly weakened, especially since 1978, 79. And there's at a time in which all of the actors who are now destroying it were partners in the great anti-Soviet game, and all went through a series of alliances and blowbacks and falling out, and now we're at a point of utter devastation. You talk about the Waziristan model, which was there, which had come through centuries of the great game to where it was when you were there in 1979. Could you look back on that and talk in terms of the prescription that you've given of trying to slowly, painfully, carefully build that up, what lessons there are?
Stephen, thank you for that question. Yes, very much so. A lot of us go back to the past and we write for all kinds of reasons about the past. I very consciously wanted to recreate the past to be able to compare it with the present, to see why we've got to where we've got to, what has been destroyed, what has been changed. And when we began to reconstruct the past, it was frightening, Stephen. All these pillars that we talk about, the Waziristan model, don't exist anymore. And the more I probed this, the more horrified I became. Because I realized that unless a process of reconstruction began, not everything, women's rights, for example, they have to be changed. You have to give rights to women. You have to have proper democracy. So suitably adjusted, if you can have some modicum of a structure being built, that is the only, to me, the only development that will halt this violence. If that doesn't happen, it's an open season right now. Nothing is checking it. Because I do not believe, and I'm talking from the field, Stephen, that violence, whether it's military or the scouts or whatever, is going to contain these suicide bombers. They can check them at one point, but they have to be tackled at source and effectively contained and removed. And that cannot happen simply by violence, because that has failed. The drones have failed. The violence has failed. Even now, you may have something like 100 or 150,000 Pakistan Army soldiers in the tribal areas. You've got drones raining down every second or third day. What's the rate, Harrison? What's the latest? How many? Every 4 days. And it hasn't checked it. So that reconstruction must start. It must come. And I'm delighted to see that someone like Khalid Aziz, who was both political agent and chief secretary of the province, completely agrees with this. And he's been taking this position consistently. It's not easy, as you can see. If you're in Washington, there's little understanding or even sympathy for any serious thinking on this. Think of it in Pakistan, where people see
very short. You can see also after Sandy Hook how difficult it is to contain even gun violence here after such horrid atrocity.
Yes, please.
Martin, be not too bad. Hi, Ambassador Ahmed. My name is Noah Brayali, and, you know, I
I wanted to address the core of your book, this concept of the core and the periphery, and in particular the crimes that are going on in the periphery. Nafisa broke our hearts telling this 45 seconds of terror and torture throughout the periphery. We're here in the core. Washington, D.C. is the equivalent of London in the time period you were reflecting back to the 19th century. This is the imperial center now. I wanted to talk ask you to reflect on the tribalism of the Afghanistan war. Your words, as you mentioned in reply to Martin a moment ago, when he asked you, why did we go there? What took the American imperial project, such as it is, to invade Afghanistan? Your reply was, it was vengeance. You know, that's a word that comes straight out of tribalism. Could you comment on the tribal character of the crimes committed by the core? We've heard from Nafisa the terrible character and the nature, the anthropology of those crimes in the periphery. What's the tribe of guys like Martin, who was advising Clinton on his terrible crimes in Israel and Palestine? Why does he still prescribe those same policies of abuse and they've been called racist and genocidal by very moderate figures like former President Carter? Thank you.
Well, no, all we need is...
By the way, there was no tribal genocide or crimes against humanity by Bill Clinton in the Israeli-Palestinian arena. As far as I recall, he spent 8 years trying to resolve that conflict. Yes.
I think, Adore, that what is needed really is to get beyond, as I said earlier, taking these positions and moving towards a compassionate understanding of the other, irrespective of the fact whether you are of one religion or one color. And that's why I constantly emphasize that we have to see the other in terms of our common humanity. That's why I emphasize that in my team, we have every religion, every major religion represented, and each member completely and passionately involved in the project. That's the only way we can change the paradigm. Or we are going to be completely stuck in this. You see that so-and-so did this, and in the past, we've got to move beyond.
Martin, you want to actually put on the tape? Akbar has made a videotape which he'd like to screen now to conclude our session. I have no idea what we're about to see, but it's a way of, wrapping up what has been a very lively and interesting discussion.
It's a message from Khalid Aziz in Peshawar, who's very much involved with the tribal areas of Pakistan. He's considered one of the country's great experts.
Crusade, then you have the problem of a religious sort of scapegoating coming into this. I mean, there is this historic background between the relationship of the Christians and Muslims. And once it was amid the war on terror, then we were actually mixing up war with crime. War seems to have its own rules and its own logic. But crime and is something of its own. Had 9/11 been investigated as a crime, I'm sure many of the mistakes that were made subsequently could have been avoided. One of the biggest blunder that took place was that the parties involved, especially the United States and the NATO allies, never really understood the enemy. And General McChrystal saying in June 2010 that he thought that the biggest problem that he faced was that we did not understand our enemy, how he lived, what were his businesses, how he made a living, what were the cultural and traditional barriers in the way, things like those. Now that has been brought up very clearly, and over the last 11 years, we've been having a lot of problems. I mean, lots of useful and important lives have been lost. And the U.S. is now running a debt of almost $9 trillion, some attributable to Afghanistan, the other bits to Iraq. Now, what are the solutions that Akbar gives in his book to deal with this? First of all, is to correct the narrative. Secondly, to understand that many of the governments around the world, and it's not only true of Fatah in Pakistan or the KP, but also true of Africa, of the Chechens, this war is being fought against the marginalized and tribal people all along its axis. And that is where the problem is. I think the first step that needs to be taken is to understand this and to stop this center's onslaught against the periphery. The second one is to give primacy to the federal principles and to become a sort of partner with the peripheral people. 50% of Pakistan belongs to them. And unless we wake up, I think we will be facing problems. Finally, I compliment Akbar Ahmed for a wonderful contribution to knowledge, and also it's a great assist to the practitioners in the field. Thank you very much.
I think that's a very fitting way to end our very lively session today, and I want to ask you all to
thank our panelists, and particularly Akbar Ahmed, for his book.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you. Thank you.